A Cydicine Plains, men who hailed from Calais, men who lived by the shallow Volturnus River, and with them Oscan levies and warlike Saticulans. Their weapons were missiles with rounded handles, which they were used to throw with whippy thongs attached. A targe protected their left side, a scimitar was carried for close work. Then Ebalus must not go unhonoured and unsung, Ebalus whom, it is said, Telon begat on the nymph Sebethis when he was king of Telebian Capria, advanced now in years. But his son, not content with his father's frontiers, even at this time held sway further afield over Sarastian tribes and the plains which the river Sarnus irrigates, over the dwellers in Rufri, Batulum, rural Selemna, and the dwellers below the town of apple-growing Abella, whose practice it was to hurl boomerangs, Celtic fashion. Their headpieces were made of bark stripped from the cork tree, their light shields plated with bronze glittered, their bronze swords glittered. The mountainy district of Nursi sent forth to the war Ufens, who had a high reputation as a successful fighter. His clan, the Equi, living on a thin soil and hardened by constant hunting over the woodlands, excelled in toughness. Armed to the teeth they are when they till the ground, and they never tire of carrying off new plunder, living on loot. Again, from the Meruvian tribe there came a priest, his helmet adorned with a favour of fruitful olive leaf, sent by his chieftain, Archippus. This hero's name was Umbro. He had a remarkable talent for hypnotizing by spell and touch the serpent kind, all evilly breathing snakes. He was able to charm their anger and cure their bites with his skill. But his art was powerless to heal the wound he got from a Trojan spear-point. Neither his soporific spells nor the simples he'd gathered on Marcian hills availed him when he was wounded. The grove of Angitia wept him. Fusinus, glassy-watered, all limpid lakes lamented him. The son of Hippolytus, too, most beautiful, went to the wars. Virbius, a fine young man, sent by his mother Aricia, who'd brought him up near the shore of the lake in Egeria's wood, where stands an altar to Diana, rich and reverenced. The legend is that Hippolytus, after he'd been laid low by his stepmother's plotting, and, torn to bits by bolting horses, had slaked with blood his father's vengeance, rose to the starry firmament and breathed the air of heaven, brought back to life by Diana's love and the herbs of Aesculapius. But then the Father Almighty, wroth that a mortal being should rise to light and life from the shades of the underground, hurled down to hell with a levin stroke from his hand this son of Phoebus, who had discovered so potent an art of healing. But Diana was kind, and hid Hippolytus in a secret place, removing him to the grove of the nymph Egeria, where he should live out his days a solitary unknown in Italian woods, having changed his name and become Virbius. Wherefore, to this day, horses are not allowed near Diana's temple or sacred wood, because horses, scared by a sea-beast, had spilt Hippolytus once and his chariot on the shore. His son, for all that, was now driving fiery horses upon the level plain, and racing to war in a chariot. Turnus himself, of magnificent build, bearing his weapons, moved amongst the leaders, a head higher than they. Upon his triple-crested tall helmet, a chimera was rampant, breathing out volcanic fire from its jaws. The bloodier waxed the battle, the more did that creature appear to roar and rage, to go berserk, and shoot forth glowering flames. But on his polished shield was blazoned in gold the image of Io, now changed to a heifer, with horns uplifted and rough-haired, a potent symbol. Also her guardian, Argus, and Inarchus, her father, pouring out his stream from a graven pitcher. At Turnus' heels there followed a cloud of infantry, packing the plain with their armoured columns, Argive warriors marching, Auruncan levies, Rutuli, old-established Sicani, Sacranian files, and the painted bucklers of the Labicans. men who ploughed Tiber's vales and the sacred coastland about the Numisius, men who worked with the plough the Rutulian hills and the promontory of Circe, men from the parts round Anxur where Jove is patron, men from the greenwoods of Feronia, the fenlands dark of Satura, and the deep combs where Ufens, cold running, winds its way down and plunges into the sea. Beside all these, there came from the Volscian nation Camilla, leading a cavalry column, squadrons petalled with bronze. A warrior maid, her woman's hand unaccustomed to womanly tasks, to the distaff, the basket of wool, a girl, but hardy to face the horrors of battle and to catch up with the winds. She could have skimmed along the blades of an unmown corn crop without so much as bruising their tender ears as she ran. She could have flitted over the waves of a swelling sea without so much as wetting the quicksilver soles of her feet. From field and cottage the young came running. The housewives gathered to stare at this Camilla and marvel as she went by, gaping, struck with amazement to see how nobly sat the cloak of royal crimson on her smooth shoulders, see the gold clasp in her hair, the Lycian quiver she carried, and the spear shaft of country myrtle with its warhead. Book 8. When Turnus hoisted the ensign of war from the Laurentine citadel, and the trumpets blared out their husky calls, when Turnus lashed his mettlesome horses and clashed his weapons, instantly men were excited. The alarm brought about a feverish uprising, and leaguing together in Latium. War hysteria gripped the youth. Now first their commanders, Messapus and Ufens, and the god-mocker Mezentius, combed the country all round for troops, so that the fields were stripped of labourers everywhere. Next was Venulus sent to the city of great Diomedes to ask his aid, and tell him that Trojans had planted themselves in Latium. Aeneas had come with a fleet, bringing in Troy's vanquished home-gods, claiming that destiny demanded he should be king there. Many tribes, what's more, were joining the cause of the Dardan hero, whose reputation was spreading all over the country. What purpose lay behind this undertaking, or what Aeneas hoped would result from a war, if fortune blessed him, would be clearer to Diomed than it was to Latinus or Turnus. So things went in Latium. Aeneas, seed of Laomedon, seeing them so, was much agitated by surging worries, his mind in feverish conflict, tossed from one side to the other, twisting and turning all ways to find a way past his dilemma. As when, in a bronze basin, the quivering water reflects a sunbeam or the round of the radiant moon, a light goes glancing hither and thither, now shooting up from the water and jigging upon the fretted ceiling over your head. It was night, and throughout the earth deep slumber lay upon all weary creatures, lay on bird and beast alike. Bedded upon the riverbank, under the chilly vault of heaven, his heart much exercised by somber thoughts about war, Aeneas at last yielded himself to sleep. Before his face there appeared now, rising amidst the leaves of the poplars out of that pleasant river, its deity, old Tiberinus. A veil of grey and gauzy stuff was draped about him, a coronal of reeds shadowed his brow. He spoke to Aeneas, relieving his troubled heart like this: O prince of divine lineage, who, out of the enemy's clutches, bring Troy town back to us, preserving it for all time. O long-awaited in the Laurentine land, in Latium, here your appointed home is, the resting place for your gods. Do not give up, or be frightened by threats of war. The swelling anger of heaven has abated. Even now, lest you think all this but a baseless fiction of sleep, you shall find, lying beneath the oaks on the river bank, a great white sow, with a litter of 30 newborn piglets, white as she, clustered at the teats of their sprawling mother. Here is the site for your city, sure terminus of your travails. And this is the sign that, when 30 years roll by, Ascanius shall found the white town Alba, the city of shining name. I prophesy certainties. Now pay heed, while I tell you briefly how you may best unravel the urgent problem before you. Arcadians, a people descended from Pallas, followers now of King Evander in peace and war, have chosen a site within this country, have built a township on the hills and named it Pallantium, after their ancestor Pallas. This people wages war persistently with the Latins, make a treaty with them, and get them onto your side. I, for my part, will conduct you straight up my waterway, that, rowing against the current, you may achieve a passage. Rise up, then, goddess-born, and with the waning stars make solemn prayer to Juno, avert her menacing wrath by vows and supplication. To me you may do honour when you're successful. I, whom you see with ample stream lipping these banks and flowing through these rich farmlands, I am Cerulean Tiber, the river most beloved by the gods. Here's my broad home. My source emerges among tall cities. Thus the river god spoke, then sank out of sight deep into his watery home. Aeneas awoke from night and dreaming, rose up, beheld the light of the orient sun in the sky, held out in solemn oblation his hands, which cupped some water scooped from the stream, and uttered these heartfelt words to heaven. Nymphs, Laurentine nymphs, you fountainheads of rivers, and you, O Father Tiber, you and your hallowed stream, bless Aeneas, keep him from harm at this long last. Wherever the secret springs of your being, and wherever you issue forth in majesty, since you have shown compassion for my hard trials, you shall be always graced with homage and offerings from me, horned river, king of Italian waters. Only be with me, confirm your revelation directly. Such were Aeneas' words. Then he chose a couple of galleys out of his fleet, manned them, and issued the crew weapons. But look! A prodigy startling, amazing for them to view. Among the trees there, shining, the same white hue as her litter, sprawled on the verdant bank for all to behold, a sow. To Juno, mightiest Juno, God-fearing Aeneas then led mother and young to stand at the altar and sacrificed them. All that night the Tiber smoothed down its poppy stream, and the current beneath its quietened surface came to a standstill, so that the face of the waters was flat as a gentle pool or a calm mere, and rowing cost no strenuous effort. So, with the river helping, they sped on the trip they had started. The well-tarred ships glide on, waters and woods admire a spectacle new to them, shields of warriors shining afar down the river, and painted hulls floating upon it. All night and the following day the Trojans rowed without respite, up the long loops of the river, under the shade of diverse trees, through the green reflection of woods in the glass-calm water. The blazing sun had climbed to the midway of heaven when they saw in the distance walls, a citadel, and a few scattered roofs. Rome's dominion has since exalted that place to the skies, but then Evander was lord of a meagre realm. Quickly the Trojans steered to the bank and approached the settlement. It happened that day the Arcadian king was holding a festival honouring Hercules, heir of Amphitryon, and the gods, in a grove outside the city. With him his son, Pallas, the younger notables all, and the plain-living senators burnt incense, while the warm blood of victims steamed at the altars. Now, when they saw the tall ships come gliding up amid the trees, through the woods' dim vistas, and the oars quietly moving, alarmed by so unexpected a sight, they started up from the banquet as one man. But Pallas, undaunted, forbade them to leave the rites unfinished. Seizing a weapon, he hurried towards the Trojans and hailed them from a vantage point at a distance. "Strangers, whither away, taking a route so strange to you? Who are you? Where do you come from? Do you bring peace or war?" Then, where he stood high up on the poop, Aeneas answered, holding out in his hand an olive branch, emblem of peace, "We are sons of Troy that you see here, and no friends to the Latins, who have driven us out of their land by a cynical act of aggression. We're looking for King Evander. Tell him a deputation of Trojan leaders has come to plead for his alliance." Pallas, struck with awe by so famous a name, called out, "Come ashore, whoever you are, sir. Come, and talk to my father yourself. Do us the honour of being a guest in our house." He extended a welcoming hand and clasped Aeneas' right hand. Leaving the riverbank, they went forward into the wood. Before long, Aeneas was making a friendly speech to the king. "Best of the sons of Greece, it is fortune's will that to you I should come for a favour, extending the formal olive branch. I do so without misgivings, although you are an Arcadian, a leader of Greeks, and related by blood to the twin Atreidae. My own merit, the sacred oracles of the gods, the kinship between our fathers, your own far-reaching fame have bound me to you, and I follow the bidding of fate most gladly." Dardanus, the progenitor and founder of Ilium's city, born, as the Greeks maintain, of Electra, daughter of Atlas, sailed to our Teucrian land. Yes, Electra's father was mighty Atlas, who holds aloft on his shoulders the heavenly firmament. Now Mercury is your father. Mercury, whom fair Maia conceived and bore upon the snowy peak of Selene. But Maia, if we believe at all the tales we have heard, was begotten by Atlas, the Atlas who props the starry sky. So, both of our families stem from the same original source. Relying on this, I launched no professional diplomatic overtures to make a compact with you. I have come in person to ask your aid, and have put my life in your hands. We are bitterly menaced in war by that same Daunian people, which persecutes you. They believe they have only to drive us out, and nothing will stop them from subjugating the whole of Hesperia, and getting control of the Adriatic and Tuscan seaboards. Exchange guarantees. My men are stout-hearted fighters, and their morale is high. As soldiers, their deeds speak for them. Thus spoke Aeneas. The king, for some time, had been watching intently his face and eyes, scrutinizing the whole man while he talked. Now he replied briefly, "Most glad am I, bravest of Trojans, to welcome and get to know you. How vividly you remind me of your great father Anchises in speech, in accent and feature. For I remember how Priam, Laomedon's son, when he travelled to visit his sister Hesione's kingdom en route for Salamis, came on from there and crossed the borders of cold Arcadia. I was a young man then, in the first flush of youth. I used to hero worship your Trojan chiefs and their prince, the son of Laomedon, but taller than any strode Anchises. I recollect in boyish enthusiasm longing to speak to the hero and shake him by the hand. I went up to him, eagerly brought him into the city of Phineus. He gave me, when he left, a very fine quiver containing Lycian arrows, a gold-embroidered scarf, and a pair of golden bridles which now are owned by my son, Pallas. And so, the hand you ask for in friendship, here, it is yours. Tomorrow, as soon as the earth grows light, I will send you away with an escort to gladden your heart, and will aid you from my resources. Meantime, this annual feast, which we cannot rightly defer, since you have come here as friends, do us the kindness of sharing it with us. Begin straight away to get used to the board of your comrades." So saying, he has the dishes and wine cups put back, which had been removed, and himself arranges the Trojans on grassy seats, inviting Aeneas, as guest of honour, to take his place on a maple chair which is draped with the shaggy pelt of a lion. Then, picked young men and the priest of the altar, promptly attentive, bring on the roast meat of bulls, and baskets loaded high with cereal food expertly prepared, and serve the wine. Aeneas and his Trojan comrades all are feeding on a whole chine of beef, and the meat left from the sacrifice. Hunger being satisfied, the desire for eating checked now, King Evander began, "These solemn ceremonies, this ritual feast, this altar, hallowed by deity, were not imposed on us by some fanciful heresy regardless of older gods. We keep up these rites, Aeneas, in honour of one who saved us from cruel danger and well deserves them. Look at that scarp up there, that overhanging rock face. See the wide scatter of boulders? How desolate stands the mountain abode, with the crags that have toppled down, gigantic debris. Once a cavern was there, deeply recessed in the hillside, impervious to the sun's rays. Its occupant was a half-human, horrible creature, Cacus. Its floor was forever warm with new spilt blood, and nailed to its insolent doors you could see men's heads hung up, their faces pallid, ghastly, decaying. This ogre was the son of Vulcan. As he moved in titan bulk, he breathed out his father's deadly flame. But to us too, in our longing that help would some day come, time brought deliverance, aid divine. For the great avenger Hercules came, in the glory of having slain and despoiled Triform Geryon. Victorious, he drove this way his great bulls, and his herds were thronged by our marshy river. Cacus, beside himself with lunatic greed, so that nothing crooked or criminal should remain undared, unattempted, rustled four bulls of surpassing build out of the steadings, and with them as many heifers, very fine creatures. These, to ensure that they left no tracks pointing the way they had gone, he dragged by their tails backwards into his cave, reversing the trail, and hid his plunder deep in the sunless rock there. A searcher would find no clues leading him to the cave. Well, when the time had come for Hercules to move on his herds from the pasturage they had cropped down, as he was going, his oxen plaintively mooed at leaving the place. Our hills and woods all rang with the lowings of the departing herd. Just then, one of the heifers, corralled within that desolate cavern, bellowed in answer, betraying Cacus' plot. Then, bitterly galled, the son of Alcides erupted in furious anger. Seizing his weapons, his heavily knotted club, he made hot foot for the top of that mountain, right up there. Then did our folk for the first time see Cacus thoroughly frightened, with panic in his eyes. He was off in a flash and running towards his cave like the wind. Fear gave wings to his feet. Now he had shut himself in there by breaking the iron chains, his father's handiwork, which held a huge rock poised, so that it fell, blocking and reinforcing the entrance like a portcullis. Next moment, Hercules, wild with rage, was there, looking this way and that to find a possible way in, grinding his teeth. Three times all over Mount Aventine he scoured in furious anger. Three times he vainly went for that rock barricade. Three times sank down in the valley, exhausted. There stood a tapering needle of flint, sheer upon all sides, which soared up out of the cave's roof, dizzily high to view. A convenient place for carrion birds to lodge their nests in. This pinnacle leaned from the ridge at an angle over the stream to its left. Hercules threw his whole weight against its right side, shook it, wrenching it loose from its deep-rooted base, then suddenly pushed. At that push, a crack like thunder rang through the wide sky. The river banks leapt apart. The river recoiled in terror. But the den of Caicus, his whole great castle, unroofed, was now visible. The dark cavern revealed to its inmost depths. It was as if the earth, violently fissured and yawning right to its depths, should uncover the regions of hell, the spectral domain unloved by the gods, and you could peer into the abyss from above and see the ghosts there flinch at the gush of daylight. As Caicus, caught in his rocky chamber, startled and shocked by the unexpected torrent of light, was uncouthly roaring, Hercules showered down arrows upon him, then anything that would do to pelt him with, boughs and immense boulders. Caicus, seeing no other escape from his predicament, belched a great cloud of smoke. You may well be amazed at this part of the story, so that a smoke screen went rolling over his lair, blotting out everything from sight, and the cave was all one thick, black, fog-bound night, shot through with glares of flame. Hercules lost all restraint in his fury at this. He hurled himself down through the fire with a headlong leap to the point where the smoke rolled thickest and billowed about the huge cave in eddying black clouds. He laid hands on the ogre, who vainly was vomiting flame through the murk, got a quick hold, knotted him double, and throttled him so that his eyes started. A hemorrhage came in his dry throat. At once the doors were torn open, and the dark den exposed, bringing to light the cattle which Caicus had stolen, the loot he'd had to disgorge, while his own grotesque carcass was dragged out by the heels. Our people could never be done with gazing at the bestial creature. His terrible eyes, his face, the bristling hair on his breast, the extinct volcano of his gullet. Since then, these rites have been practiced. This day kept holy by grateful posterity, headed by its founder, Potitius, and by the Pinarian family, wardens of the worship of Hercules. This altar, which he himself set up in the grove here, always shall be for us, in name and in truth, the Ara Maxima. Come then, my friends! Do honour to such heroic feats. Garland your hair with leaves, solemnly raise the wine cups, call on the gods we share now, and freely offer libation. Evander had spoken. The shade of silver-green poplar, an emblem of Hercules, twined his hair. A circlet of leaves with a pendant. The consecrated chalice was in his right hand. At once, with a will, they all made libation and put up a prayer to the gods. Evening the while drew nearer, hastening down the sky. So now the priests went forth, Potitius at their head, robed in hides, their traditional vestment, and carrying torches. Renewing the feast, they brought on welcome offerings to furnish a second banquet, and piled the altars with loaded dishes. The Salii, too, their temples, enwreathed with poplar leaves, stood by at the kindled altars, ready to sing. One choir of young men, one of older, who now rehearsed in song the feats and fame of Hercules, how as a babe he strangled two snakes, the first of the monsters raised up in his path by his stepmother, how he tore, stone from stone, two cities renowned in war, Troy and Icalia, how, at the will of that same stepmother, hostile Juno, he went through a thousand heavy labours for King Eurystheus. Invincible hero, you killed the cloud-born centaurs, Helios and Pholus. You killed the monster of Crete. You killed the huge great lion in the Nemean den. You daunted the river Styx, and the watchdog of hell couched on a pile of half-gnawed bones within its blood-stained cave. Nothing you saw could affright you. not even Typhoeus himself, that towering, armoured Titan. You did not lose your nerve when the heads of the Lernaean dragon encircled you like a mob. All hail, true son of Jove, new splendour in the pantheon. Graciously grant your favouring presence to us, your worshippers. Such was the paean they sang in his honour, crowning it with a passage about fire-breathing Cacus himself and his cavern. The woods all rang with their singing, the hills echoed it back. As soon as the sacred rites had been completed, they went home to the town in a body. The aged king, as he walked, kept his son and Aeneas beside him for company, whiling away the road in talk on various subjects. Aeneas was looking around him with unforced admiration, enthralled by the scenes they passed through, eagerly asking questions and hearing the stories behind those monuments of past ages. Then King Evander, the founder of Rome's citadel, said, "These woods were once the home of indigenous fauns and nymphs, and of men who had sprung from hardwood oaks, who had no settled way of life, no civilization. Ploughing, the forming of communal reserves and economy were unknown then. They lived on the produce of trees and hard-won fare of the hunter. The first thing was that Saturn came hither from Olympus, an exile deprived of his kingdom, fleeing the power of Jove. He made a united nation of this intractable folk scattered among the hills, gave laws to them, chose the name of Latium, a word suggesting the safe refuge he had found here. His reign was the period called in legend the Golden Age, so peacefully serene were the lives of his subjects. It lasted till, little by little, the time grew tarnished, an age of baser metal came in, of mad aggression and lust for gain. Orsonian hordes and tribesmen from Sicily arrived then, and more than once the land of Saturn resigned its name. Tyrants arose, for example, the harsh, huge-bodied Thybris, from whom in later days our Italian river was called the Tiber, and lost its original name, which used to be Albula. I myself, an exile seeking the ocean's uttermost verge, at the will of all-powerful fortune of inescapable destiny, settled here. I had followed the solemn warnings my mother, the nymph Carmentis, gave me, inspired by Apollo. He finished, and going a little way onward, was able to point out the altar and the Carmental Gate, as Romans call it, which were set up of yore to honour the nymph Carmentis, prophetic seeress, the first to foretell how great would be Aeneas' line, how glorious the town of Pelantium. Next he showed a large grove, which later the active Romulus called a retreat, and a cave on the cold hillside, the Lupercal, named in Arcadian fashion after Lycian Pan. He pointed out also the sacred wood of Argilitum, explained how his guest Argos had died, showing the very spot. From here he took them along to the Tarpeian site and the Capitol, golden today, but then a tangle of thicket. Even at that time the timorous countrymen went in awe of the god-haunted feel of the place, trembled at wood and rock. Evander remarked, "This wood, this hill, with its leafy crest, some god inhabits, though which we cannot be sure. The Arcadians believe they have witnessed great Jove himself, seen him repeatedly shaking his dark aegis and summoning up the storm clouds. Now look at those ruined walls. There used to be two towns there, and what you see are the relics, the monuments of a past age. Janus built a citadel here. There Saturn built one. This was called the Janiculum, that other the Saturnian." Conversing thus together, they approached the unpretentious dwelling of Evander. Cattle were everywhere, lowing in what is now the Forum of Rome and the elegant ship place. Arrived at the palace, the king said, "Hercules stooped to enter this door. this humble palace received the conquering hero. Have the courage, my guest, to despise possessions. Train yourself as he to be worthy of Godhead. Don't be intolerant of poverty." Evander, with these words, led tall Aeneas beneath the roof of his simple dwelling, and gave him a couch of leaves with a coverlet made from the skin of a Libyan bear to sleep in. Night came down, enfolding the earth in her dusky wings. Venus, her mother's heart alarmed, as well it might be, perturbed by the threats and the fierce uprising of the Laurentines, spoke to her husband, Vulcan, as they lay in their gold bedchamber, breathing into the words all her divine allurement. "While Argive kings assaulted in war the foredoomed stronghold of Pergamum, the towers destined to fall in flames, I asked no help of you for my unhappy people, made no demands on your skill and resource as a forger of weapons. I did not care to put you to work that was bound to be wasted, dearest husband, although I owed a great debt to the sons of Priam, and often had grieved at the ordeal Aeneas was suffering. Now, at the will of Jove, he has set foot in Italy. Yet it is now that I'm asking a deity whom I reverence for arms, appealing to you on my son's behalf. You were moved by the tears of Thetis once, and the tears of the wife of Tithonus. See what people are mustering, what cities have barred their gates, and are sharpening weapons against me to exterminate those I love." Since Vulcan complied not at once, the goddess softly embraced him in snowdrift arms, caressing him here and there. Of a sudden, he caught the familiar spark and felt the old warmth darting into his marrow, coursing right through his body, melting him. Just as it often happens, a thunderclap starts a flaming rent which ladders the dark cloud, a quivering streak of fire. Pleased with her wiles and aware of her beauty, Venus could feel them taking effect. Vulcan, in love's undying thrall, said, "You need not delve in the past for persuasions. What has become of your trust in me, my goddess? If you had brought me your troubles that other time, then, too, I could rightfully have armed the Trojans. For neither the Father Almighty nor fate's decrees forbade that Troy should stand or Priam survive another 10 years. And now, if your purpose is to make all ready for warfare, any effort that's mine to give in the exercise of my craft, whatever can be done with iron and molten alloys, all work of furnace and bellows, nay, plead no more. Why need you cast doubt upon your influence over me?" Thus saying, he gave his wife the love he was aching to give her. Then he sank into soothing sleep, relaxed upon her breast. As soon as he'd woken, rested, requiring to sleep no longer, in the small hours when night was waning, the time when the housewife, who must eke out a slender livelihood with her loom and distaff, pokes the drowsy embers upon the hearth, making night too a work time, and keeping her maids employed at the long shift by lamplight, so that her married life and the bringing up of her little sons be not endangered. Just so, and active as she at that very hour, did the Fire Lord rise from his downy bed and go to his ironworks. Between the Sicilian coast and Aeolian Lipari, there's an island whose cliffs, sheer rising, jet out smoke from their crannies. Deep within it are vaults, a rumbling volcanic cavern, scooped out by the action of the Cyclops fires. You can hear the clang of hard blows on the anvils, the roaring when masses of ore are smelted within, and a throbbing blast of flame from the furnaces. Here is Vulcan's place. The island is called Vulcania, Hither now the fire god repaired from heaven above. The Cyclops were hard at work in this underground iron foundry. Brontes and Steropes, Pyracmon, stripped to the buff. They manufactured a thunderbolt, such as the Father of Heaven shoots down in such great numbers at Earth from all over the sky. Part of it was already streamlined, part unfinished. They had given it 3 fins of twirling sleet, and 3 of cloudburst, 3 of russet fire, and 3 of storm wind. Now they were putting in as components frightening flashes, the noise that creates panic, the piercing flames of wrath. Elsewhere, a job was being hurried on for Mars, a chariot with swift wheels, such as he rides in to rouse up men and nations. Some busily burnished the aegis Athene wears in her angry moods, a fearsome thing with a surface of gold, like scaly snakeskin, and the linked serpents and the Gorgon herself upon the goddess' breast, a severed head rolling its eyes.
"Put all that work aside. Pack in the jobs you're engaged on, you Cyclops of Mount Etna, and turn your attention to this, the making of arms for a hot-blooded hero. Now there is need for your strength, your speediest work, and your master craftsmanship. Get bustling on it at once."
That was all Vulcan said. Quickly they set to the business, shared out the tasks among them equally. Rivers of molten bronze and gold are flowing. The deadly steel is smelted in an immense furnace. They fashion a shield of heroic size, to withstand by itself every missile the Latins can use, welding 7 rounds of metal one on another to make it. Some pump away at the bellows, drawing in air and expelling it. Some dip the hissing metal in troughs. The cavern groans under the stress of anvils. They raise their arms with the powerful alternate rhythm of cranks. They keep the iron ore turning in the close grip of their tongs. While on Aeolian shores, the Lord of Lemnos was hurrying forward this work. Evander was roused from his humble dwelling by the genial light and the dawn song of birds beneath his eaves. The old man got out of bed, clothed himself in a tunic, and laced the Tyrene clogs on his feet. Then shouldered a baldric, so that his sword of Tegea could hang at his side, and threw a panther skin over his left shoulder to dangle behind him. 2 dogs, his bodyguard, preceded him as he stepped through the doorway, and went with their master on his errand. He made for the private room where his guest Aeneas was lodged, for he'd not forgotten their talk, the old hero, or what he had promised. Aeneas, too, was up and about that early morning. Achates walked at his side, at Evander's, his son Pallas. The 4 of them met, shook hands, then retired to an inner room where they could sit and at last converse together freely. The king began. "Great captain of the Teucrians, believe me, I'll never admit the cause of Troy is lost, or its hope of dominion while you are alive. Though our reputation is high, we are short in the sinews of war to aid you. Confined as we are on this side by the Tiber, hard pressed on that by the Rutuli, whose arms clang round our walls. But I propose to bring to your side a confederation of rich and numerous peoples. An unforeseen chance has offered this reinforcement. It must have been fate that brought you here. Not far away lies Caere, a populous city founded on ancient rock. A tribe from Lydia, renowned in war, settled it long ago upon a hill of Etruria. For many years they flourished, but there rose a king, Mezentius, who with insolent tyranny and cruel force oppressed them. I will not enlarge on that despot's brutish acts or his damnable massacres. May the gods keep such things for himself and his breed. Why, he would even have live men bound to dead bodies, clamping them hand to hand and face to face, a horrible method of torture, so that they died a lingering death, infected with putrefaction in that most vile embrace. At last the townsfolk could stand it no more. They rose in arms against the criminal maniac, besieged him in his palace, put his friends to the sword, and set the place alight. But Mezentius somehow escaped through the slaughter into Rutulian territory and asked his guest friend Turnus for protection. So all Etruria has risen in righteous anger, demanding his extradition for punishment, or else they'll make war at once. Thousands they are, Aeneas, and I'll put you at their head. You see, their invasion fleet is serried along the shore, and they're clamoring to advance. But an aged seer restrains them, uttering fate's decree. You crack troops of the Etruscans, you flower and chivalry of an ancient people, your honest indignation, your just wrath at Mezentius spur you against the foe, but no Italian may lead a team of such fighters as you. You must find a foreign commander. At this, the Etruscan army, awed by the warning of heaven, settled back on the plain there. Tarchon himself has sent me ambassadors with the royal crown and scepter, offering the insignia of his power if I will go to their camp and take over command of the Etruscans. But I cannot accept it, for I am outworn with years. Old age has chilled my blood and withered my aptitude for adventure. I'd encourage my son to go, were it not that he inherits Italian blood from his mother, a Sabine. But you are the right man in age and race, fate's chosen, the one the divine will calls for. Go then, most valiant leader of Trojans and of Italians. Besides, you shall have my son here, my hope and consolation, Pallas, that under your tuition he may be trained in soldiering, the rough work of war, to endure its rigours, and watching your deeds, to model himself on you from the start. Him will I give 200 Arcadian horsemen, the flower of our youth, and Pallas shall give you 200 in his own name. He had barely finished speaking. Aeneas, son of Anchises, and his confidant, Achates, their eyes downcast, were reflecting sadly on the hard trials before them, and long would have done so, but that Venus sent them a sign out of the clear sky. All of a sudden, the heavens shook with a flash of lightning, and thunder pealed. It seemed as if the whole universe suddenly tottered, and Etruscan trumpets were bawling above them. They looked up. Again and again, a terrific crash resounded. Up there, among the fleecy clouds in the fair-weather sky, were arms, red-glinting and thunderously clashing through the clear air. The rest were stunned with amazement. But the Trojan hero heard in the sound his divine mother keeping a promise she'd given. So then he exclaimed, "My friend, do not, oh, do not ask what issue these portents may bring. They're a call from above, and the call is for me. My goddess mother foretold she would send this sign if war was looming close, and would come to my help through the air with arms of Vulcan's making. Ah, what terrible slaughter awaits the Laurentines now! What a price you will pay me, Turnus! How many shields and helmets and corpses of gallant men shall the Tiber roll beneath its waves? Now let them clamour for war and break their treaties." When he'd said this, Aeneas got up from where he was sitting, and at once rekindling the drowsy fire on the altar of Hercules, cheerfully paid his respects to the guardian of the house and its humble gods, as he'd done on the previous day. Evander sacrificed duly chosen sheep, and the Trojans likewise. Then Aeneas returned to the ships, where the rest of his comrades were, and selected the bravest of them to accompany him upon his military mission, while the remainder floated effortlessly down the glass-calm river, borne by its current, to tell Ascanius how it fared with his father and the rest. The Trojans, on their way to the Etruscan camp, were furnished with horses. For Aeneas, a specially fine one, housed in the tawny skin of a lion, with glittering, gilded claws. The news was quickly spread abroad through the little township that men were riding post-haste to the Etruscan king. In apprehension, the mothers pray harder. Fear walks closer in peril's train, and the spectre of war looms larger now. Then did Evander, weeping uncontrollably, cling to the hand of his departing son Pallas, and say, "If Jupiter would only restore those bygone years, and the man I was, when under Praeneste's walls I laid the front rank low, and triumphantly burnt the piled-up shields. Yes, and with this right hand I dispatched to Hades King Erulus, he whom his mother, Feronia, had given at birth 3 lives, frightening it is to relate, and 3 sets of equipment. Thrice over he had to be slain. Yet on that day my strong hand took all his lives away, and 3 times despoiled him of armour. The man I was then would not have been torn from you now, my dear son, that's sure. Nor would Mezentius ever have heaped such insults on me, his neighbour, with all those killings he ruthlessly has perpetrated, depriving my town of so many citizens. Ye heaven-dwellers, and you, great ruler of the gods, Jupiter, have compassion for an Arcadian king, and hear a father's prayer, I implore you. If your will, and fate's it is, to keep my Pallas safe and sound for me, if I am living to see him again to be with him, then let me live. For that I can bear any burden. But if fortune means something I dare not speak of to happen to him, let me be rid of my bitter existence this very moment, before anxiety becomes certainty, and hope dies in the known event. Yes, now, as I hold you, dear lad, my last lone joy, or ever some terrible tidings should hurt my ears. So, at their final parting, the old man spoke from his heart. Then he collapsed, and his servants carried him into the house. And now the gates had been opened, and the horsemen had sallied forth, Aeneas with his close friend Achates among the leaders. Next, other Trojan princes. Pallas himself was riding in the middle of the column, his tunic and blazoned armour conspicuous, just like the morning star, beloved by Venus above all the stars of heaven when it rises from bathing in ocean deeps and puts forth its holy light from the sky and melts the darkness. On the city wall stand the mothers, trembling. Their eyes follow those squadrons, flashes of bronze and a dust cloud rolling about them. The armoured horsemen, taking a short cut, pick their way through brushwood. Then loud shouts are heard as, all in a body, with clatter of hammering hooves, they go galloping over the dry flats. There's an extensive woodland near the cool stream of Caere, reverenced by all around in the faith of their fathers. Encircled by hills, that wood of dark green fir trees lay in a hollow. The legend is that the ancient Pelasgians, the first settlers of Latium in the old days, had dedicated the wood and a festival day to Silvanus, the god of fields and cattle. Not far from here were Tarchon and his Etruscans, camped in a good defensive position. And now, from the hills above, they could see the whole of his army, their tents all over the plain. Aeneas, leading his chosen combat brigade, soon entered the camp. His tired men saw to their horses, and then their own comfort. Venus, divinely shining among the dark clouds, descended bringing her presence. When she had seen from afar Aeneas on the other side of a cool stream in a secluded dell, she offered herself to his view quite unexpectedly, saying, "Look, Here are the presents my consort promised. All his science has gone to their making. Now you need not shrink from challenging haughty Laurentines and hot-headed Turnus to battle, my son. With these words, the Cytherean went into her son's embrace, the radiant arms she had propped up against an oak before him. Aeneas, overjoyed by her gifts and the glory of them, eyed each piece, couldn't have enough of gazing. In wonder, he took them up with his hands, in his arms, examining each. The formidable helmet, with plumes like fountains of fire, the sword that would deal out doom, the breastplate of hard bronze, massive and ruddy-coloured, like to some lowering cloud when it catches fire from the rays of the sun and glows afar. Then the burnished greaves of gold alloy inlaid with high-carat gold, and the spear, and the shield's miraculous workmanship. Upon this shield, the fire god, with knowledge of things to come, being versed in the prophets, had wrought events from Italian history and Roman triumphs. Upon it appeared the whole line that would spring from Ascanius' stock, and the wars they would fight in, one by one. He had depicted the mother wolf as she lay full length in the green-swarded cave of Mars, with the twin boy babies fondling and suckling at her udders, fearlessly nuzzling their dam. She, her graceful neck bent sideways and back, is caressing each child in turn with her tongue, licking them into shape. Nearby, he had pictured the Sabine women, so unceremoniously snatched from among the crowds around the arena at Rome during the great games. Then the war that immediately came, between Romulus' people and Tatius' hard-living Sabines. Next, these same two kings, their quarrel laid aside, are standing at Jove's altar, armed with bowls in their hands, ratifying a treaty by the sacrifice of a sow. Near this was the scene where chariots, driven apart, had torn Metis to pieces. But you should have kept to your word, Alban. Tullus is dragging away the remains of that false-tongued man through a wood, and the brambles there are drenched with a bloody dew. Again, you could see Porsenna telling the Romans to take back the banished Tarquin, and laying strenuous siege to Rome, while the sons of Aeneas took up the sword for freedom's sake. He was pictured there to the life, pouring out threats and wild with chagrin, seeing that Cocles dared to break down the bridge, and Cloelia had slipped her fetters and was swimming across the river. At the top of the shield, Manlius, warden of the Tarpeian fortress, stood before the temple, guarding the Capitol. The palace, just built by Romulus, being shown with a rough thatched roof. Here, too, a silvery goose went fluttering through a golden colonnade, honking out an alarm that the Gauls are on us. Under the cover of a dark night, lucky for them, the Gauls creep closer through the brushwood. Some have already scaled the citadel's heights. Their clothing and hair were done in gold. The stripes on their cloaks are gleaming. About their fair-skinned throats are necklaces fastened. Each of them brandishes two alpine spears in his hand and carries a tall, narrow shield for protection. Vulcan had also embossed the dancing Salii and naked Lupaci, their headdresses bound with wool, and the shields that fell from heaven. A solemn procession of virtuous ladies was moving in cushioned carriages through the city. Elsewhere, the deep gates of hell were represented, the domicile of the damned and the torments they suffer. Catiline hangs from the edge of a terrible precipice, shrinking away from the faces of furies above him. But the righteous are set apart, with Cato as their lawgiver. Among these subjects extended a wide and swelling sea. It was done in gold, yet it looked like the blue sea foaming with white caps. Dolphins, picked out in silver, were cartwheeling all around, lashing the face of the deep with their tails and cleaving the water. Centrally were displayed two fleets of bronze, engaged in the Battle of Actium. All about Cape Lucas you saw brisk movement of naval formations. The sea was a blaze of gold. On one side, Augustus Caesar.